Hello and welcome to the Dance Futures podcast, a podcast that discusses dance as a way of life with people who've made it central to theirs. I'm your host, Dr. Ruth Pethybridge, professional dance geek, and this, sneaking in just before the end of the month, is the April edition. This month I speak with dance artist Cecilia McFarlane, who was kind of instrumental in shaping my own twisted and roundabout pathway into dance and having dance as a central part of my career. Cecilia has worked in dance for over 35 years. She was recognised for this contribution to the sector by People Dancing, the Foundation of Community Dance, and you will hear why she continues to do it, why she continues to dance and perform in this interview. For those of you, any new listeners to the podcast, we'll also have our digest of the interview with recent dance and choreography graduate Luca Vaccari afterwards, so do stick around for that at about an hour. That's the point that happens. And he usually joins us from a props cupboard in Frankfurt. That's just for reference, because I got overexcited when I saw that he was no longer in that cupboard. And then at the end of the episode, I will treat you to a little geekery, which is my way of just framing the fact that I am super enthusiastic about my little niche in dance academia. And the Dance Geek Out section is really a chance to try and share some theory or scholarship or research from the field in a more accessible way in about things that kind of connect to stuff that came up in the interview. So again, if that floats your boat and you want to listen to just that bit, you can skip forward to about an hour 11. But I recommend you listen to the whole thing, obviously, maybe with the odd dance break. Okay, enjoy and see you on the other side. Hello, Cecilia McFarlane. Welcome to the Dance Futures podcast.
So
that was our attempt at pretending we haven't already been talking for 30 minutes. I feel like I'm cheating not to admit that I have worked and known you for a very long time. It feels really appropriate to have gone from my last episode was a graduate special. So it was people who I worked with as a teacher talking to me about where they're at now. And I feel like now talking to you for this episode is speaking to someone who was my teacher and mentor. And kind of, so it's really lovely to feel those different kinds of relationships coming into the conversation, really. So my first question is about just describing your practice. So we've spoken about, we've just mentioned, didn't we, about this thing of you've had a very long career and there's a temptation maybe to think about a chronology, a kind of like it began here and then and then and then and then. But I would really like to start with now and thinking about if you were at a dinner party and someone said, what do you do or what is your practice? How would you respond to that and describe it as you are here and now?
It's a good question. And I would out and proud say I'm a dancer. But people hesitate when they hear that, because they imagine I was a dancer, but I'm not one anymore because I'm 74 and people are ageist about everything, including specifically dance. So I would say I am a dancer. And I would also say I was a dancer before I was born, because I think we're dancing in the womb. I think it's the original art form. And I would also say my last blink, because I see a blink of an eye as a dance, will be my last dance. And one of the things that I was questioned on by when I said this at a conference many years ago, a dancer said to me, another fellow presenter said to me, why then? Why is that your last dance? So I now say, and I don't know what will be after, but I'd like to think there's a dance after. So I'm holding on to this career of mine, this trade of mine as a dancer for all my life and after.
Nice. And so if that saying That, and it's interesting. I'm just reflecting how, again, speaking to my graduates, I think the conversation came up about at what point can you say I'm an artist? And that's been a through line as well, as people going, the more younger recent graduates kind of grappling with at what point can I say I'm a dancer and I'm an artist and kind of own that title. So it's really lovely to hear you just going, yep, that's what I am. And I'm going to kind of really proudly state that. But if you were talking then, say the conversation evolves around the dinner table, a couple of glasses of wine in, if you had to describe, if they went, so what kind of dance, or how are you a dancer, or how would you describe the actual work that you do, I guess?
Yeah, and it would become quite a long bit, and it would be a bit of a monologue that other people around
you
the table.
You go for it. Well, this is what the podcast is for. So,
so my monologue is, and my passion, as I've got older, I've got ridiculously, I've got more confident about my dance and being a dancer. So I guess one of the things, there's many things, but one of the things about my dance is that if I had had whatever we describe as a perfect body, and that I had a career that was maybe where I might have gone had I been a really good ballet dancer when I was a child training, then I would have had a career that would have inevitably stopped at 36 or whatever, or when I got pregnant with a child or whatever. So I would have then had to choose another career because I wasn't any good. I don't think I'd have been in the kind of place that translates, that uses this precious word, which is translate. As it is, I'm a dancer who's always had awareness, and sometimes struggling with it, but an awful, and more recently actually celebrating it, who's different, who I'm not. People look at me and they wouldn't say I'm a dancer. I've never been thin enough. I haven't been loose enough. And I'm passionate about giving people, and this is where my career, and so much you know from the work we've done together, is about trying to take away the labels that are attached to being a dancer, and the fact that they're some kind of entertainer. You know, the radio program that you can go to find my work, which is Go Dance Your Life Away, that was my head teacher saying to me when I left my Catholic convent at 18, 19. She said, go dance your life away. And I'm sure she thought, because she knew I wasn't a ballet dancer, I'm sure she thought I was going to be summer seasons, pantomimes, that kind of thing, nightclubs. And she had no clue that my dance would take me to hospitals, to prisons, to teaching people in different settings and translating into dance being something for everyone.
Nice. So can you mentioned there the word training, and you said you know, maybe if I'd had the perfect body, this, that, and how that's shaped how your identity and your experience of being other in some way to this idea of the dance has shaped what you do now and how you work. But you mentioned training, and of course there is a training there. You did have a training. Can you talk about your not necessarily the training itself, although that might come up, but your relationship to that training? So
well, I did only have ballet training really when I was a kid, and a bit of ballroom and tap and stuff, and it was very clear I wasn't good enough ballet dancer to become a ballerina. And at that point in the 70s, it really was the only job available if you were going to be serious about dance and not pantomime, etc. And so I knew I'd have to therefore go to teacher's training college and learn how to teach. And so I wish I'd gone to Dartington, because that was just coming out, but I went to the Royal Academy of Dancing, it was called then, and had an audition for there and another place as well, and chose the Royal Academy, knowing that I was then training to become a teacher of ballet. And it was good enough to think that, but actually it wasn't. I didn't feel happy with the idea that I wouldn't have a performance side to my work, because it felt like integral and something that's fundamental to how I had performed as a child, and I wanted to go on sharing my work, my making, and have the opportunity to make. And then while I was at the Royal Academy, they started brand new class started, because it was when London Contemporary was just beginning, the place was just opening, and we had this strange subject called Martha Graham, and we had it once a week in the evening as an option when I was at the Academy, and we found the delight of having bare feet and sitting on the floor, and this was like, oh my gosh, I'm in another land. And long story short, obviously I did that a lot. One year we were based at the place rather than at the Academy. We our Royal Academy was based at the place for a year in the beginning. And I remember looking at everybody in the changing room and thinking, I'm in the wrong thing here. I had my hairnet on and my tutu on and point shoes. And looking at all people like Emlyn was there, people like Kate Flack, you know, all those different people who were there. And thinking, I'm in the wrong place. I'm in the wrong room. And feeling embarrassed by this person who was in her character skirt because she was just about to do character dance. Anyway, so I then started, we then moved out after a year and I had another year to finish the Royal Academy. And I was a finisher. So I thought, yep, now I'll go on. I'll do my Royal Academy training. But I want to do, which was effectively the equivalent of a BA, but it wasn't then labelled like that. And so then I thought I'll do a fourth year. And that's when I did my 1 year course at the place. And that was a time to turn around completely and almost too late, but not, because I'd got my advanced ballet training. I could do the syllabus, but I'm a body that was being really distorted by it. So then the lesson that I learned when I went for my 1 year at the place, which I so loved, was that I had to unlearn so much. My body had lost any ability to know naturally how it would move, and probably quite a lot of damage on the hips that won't turn out properly and all the rest of it. So I used it hugely, loved it. But it only just got me through. And as Sarah Watley said, when I worked with her a lot, she said, well, that's the equivalent of your MA that didn't exist in those days.
Yeah,
so that was the beginning.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about unlearning, because I feel like that's another theme that's come up quite a lot through the different episodes of this podcast, as people are talking about how much they have to unlearn in order to find their own practice.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because there can be a tendency as dancers, again, that there's a sort of blank slate, an idea that you're somehow a blank slate that other people sort of put movement or ideas onto, and you sort of take those on, and then how you then find a voice or your like unique contribution to choreographic processes or whatever is a longer process that involves this undoing or unlearning or resistance. It's been called different things, but it definitely feels like that's a thread.
And I would question your use of the word blank slate, because I don't think people audition for these places, and you're certainly not a blank slate.
No, that's what I'm saying, is that that's a misconception.
Absolutely. And you're only chosen because your slate, your body, is the right. Obviously, we know athletes have to have the certain type of body, but it's the idea that we have to change the expectations of what we think, particularly female dancers, are.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel like you're seeing that change more now? Do you feel like that's a fight that is still ongoing?
Well, I'm sad in that I do think it's still sexist. I think, as you know, but I've got, you know, I had 32 years of teaching children how to dance, letting children find their own dance, the kind of dance that I would have liked and didn't have, and hugely successful. I didn't expect it to be that successful, with parents doing the dance and grandparents and grandchildren, and a huge celebration of so many people dancing. But what I'm sad about is that I started Oxford Youth Dance up, which is what I did when we came temporarily to Oxford and then stayed, was I started it because I wanted children to know, my children to begin with, but every child I work with, that there was more to dance, I'm afraid, than ballet, and that their body and how it moved individually and uniquely was the way we needed to start with our dance. So that's where I started. And I wanted people to come out at the end. I didn't want to meet people who said, I can't dance. And when I said to them, what do you mean you can't dance? And they said, well, I got too tall for ballet, or I wasn't good enough, or I wasn't loose enough. So I wanted people to embrace a subject, my subject, the subject I'm passionate about. I wanted them to be able to embrace it by saying, yes, I can dance. So I have got that. I have done that. And people now all over the world who I've worked with are able to dance. But my sadness and the sort of political stuff of this is that I didn't set out to create performers who would be successful, but of all the children who turned into adults that I've taught, it's the boys, the men, who become successful. And the women, some of them have become successful, but also some of them hugely damaged by the expectations of what their bodies should be like. And that makes me really angry, because it's like, you know, it shouldn't still be happening, that. And it is.
So I talk to my students sometimes about sort of redefining success in relation to dance as well. And I was thinking about that and just thinking what you said. And I had a realization where I was like, oh, well, I'm one of the people who's come through Oxford Youth Dance and can count as a success. But it's still, it's not that kind of high profile performance trajectory, I suppose, that still maybe epitomizes something of success, you know, that we think of these people getting into these really high end companies and touring internationally. And so I often talk to my students about a kind of the sort of roundabout higgledy-piggledy pathway through dancing and dance that I did as well, which was not necessarily what I expected or even wanted, but just somehow knew that dance was needed to be central. And then everything else kind of came from that. And realizing that certain spaces and like auditions, for example, weren't for me because it was just too traumatic not being chosen over and over again. So yeah, I'm curious about that, about the boys sort of doing better, if you like, in one sense, but also I do remember something about the lack of expectation that the boys had in Oxford Youth Dance sometimes in terms of what dance was, meant that there was this amazing exuberant freedom in the way that they would respond to improvisation, which I really took from a lot of your work, was working with structured improvisation as a way to draw out these qualities in people was so key. There was this kind of freedom in what they were doing that sometimes the girls, a bit more self-consciousness or something. I mean, I'm also struggling with sort of being too gender binary about it in terms of these sort of stereotypes and not wanting to compound them, but it's just a fascinating observation, I guess, from you that about
absolutely. Yeah. And you know, and there would have been, I never did the figures on it, but there would have been a lot of the girls, the women, the young girls who came, who in early days would have gone to ballet, you know, they'd have tried out ballet and maybe be doing both, whereas the boys mostly didn't, although they did start to dip into it. But I met a male dancer he's one of my guys who isn't a dancer, but he is, everybody's a dancer, he didn't go training as a dancer, but he said to me the other day, his father I think said to me, we took him to ballet and everybody looked at him and laughed at him because he was going to ballet and he was completely put off movement, and then only when he had your classes did he realize that he could dance and he was okay to dance. So we were at that point, I mean, we are talking quite a, you know, 30 years ago, but it was that point where it was dodgy for a boy, a young mother, father to take him, mother normally take him to dance, even if it was contemporary dance, so creative dance. Yeah, but I think one of the things which colours the career thing, and you mentioned auditions and all of the agony or not of what that is, I do think it's still happening, really. But we've had a tranche of male choreographers who look, all choreographers look for a specific thing in females, but they have a very different expectation of what they look for in men. So men don't have to come with a certain size, and they can come, you know, with street clothes. They can be the more street they are. I'm not going to name choreographers, but we all know choreographers who love the boys off the street, the men off the street, and they expect women to be very different. And you can't have a woman off the street of any variety. Up till recently, I'd like to think it's now changing, but it was a stereotype. The girls, the women, the girls were stereotyped. And so you could just walk into an audition. I remember so many of the boys who got into training schools, like The Place and everywhere else, they got in with hardly having to do anything because they were a boy, because they were male. Yeah. And the shortage and the numbers were so different.
Yeah, and I think there is that.
Always going to be possibly there.
That yes, and there's a whole bunch of societal underpinnings there about how we view gender and what we view as appropriate behaviours for different genders, etc., which again is a theme that's definitely come up a lot. But I want to circle back to your practice, because you've taken a step back from teaching now after a really long, is that right? I mean, you're teaching young people.
I'm not teaching the youth. I did it for 32 yeah. years every
yeah,
Saturday.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. You've done long enough.
I miss it hugely. I miss it. Of course, because it fed me. I was teaching, but goodness me, it was a two-way, three-way process. It came to me far more than, it was just so feeding, and it fed everything else I did. Even now, I teach the adult group, which is the parents who came to me and said, hey, can we have what you give our children?
Nice,
those years ago, sort of 25, 6 years ago, that group started and Dugout started. And even now, I find myself suddenly saying, oh, I did this with the children. Let's do this. This is worth doing across the floor because you'll get it. And it's in a language which is, you know, pebbles and beaches and water and sea. And we become very young, but they move in a way that's accessing the young them, as opposed to the older person who thinks, well, I can't do this stuff. And no one ever says, oh, this is childish. The word childish is an absolute rotten thing to say. If you're childish, you're doing really well.
Yeah, well, there's an element of sort of play, isn't there, that I think adults really need in their life, and that a lot of, I feel, dance practice, the more open improvisation based dance practice can give us, is certainly one of the places where I find joy, which connects to maybe a sort of childlike energy or presence. But yeah, like you say, that is not a slur, that's a positive. So I suppose I was curious about, you mentioned performing and, you know, owning your dancerness, and so I'm wondering about how are you performing at the moment. Are you working on anything for yourself, and what is that relationship then between your teaching and your performance? Can you articulate a bit more about that?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because the answer becomes clearer and clearer as I get older, actually. I know that I think I could never have taught unless I had my own practice, and my practice might be going to the gym, it might be going to a class once a week, or it might be actually making sure I've got something I'm making that I'm going to perform. And actually, that's a really fundamental one. And I remember, well, just jumping to lockdown, a really good friend who knows my work really well, and he said to me, well, I guess you've retired now. And I nearly blew up, because I actually said, you know me well enough, I'm not going to retire. That's not a word I'm going to use. And and then I talked to somebody recently, and when in lockdown particularly, but even after, she described what I was talking. She had her fingers sort of wiggling in a way that was, and she talked about, it's like kindling. You need something kindling. And I do. I need the fire in my belly. And it doesn't matter if I'm making a piece of work that's just a once off and never happen again, and I made it over the course of 3 days, or whether it's something that I'm brewing for another project. And I've always had projects. So Crossover, which you were involved in, was an intergenerational group. And it was the time when we were beginning, dance was beginning to say older people can dance. But actually, it was still very stereotyped that there was youth groups and there were professionals, and what was an intergenerational dance company, and was it professional and whatever. So I gave birth to this project, which was at the time quite new, and included myself in it. So I had two people of each decade, really, eight dancers, and I was the top two decades, as it were, with another dancer. And then the youngest were two who were, there was four girls, four men, four women, and the youngest two were sort of about 8 to 10, something like that. And we went on for probably 10 years or more, and we were very popular, and it was a very important thing. And what was really good about it was that people from the audiences all said, we can see ourselves in this performance. Mm. So where we look at dance, say a ballet thing, and it's beautiful, but it's kind of voyeuristic, like looking at Greek statues or whatever. So it was just like people could see themselves. They could see their granny in it, or they could see their child who's grown up in it, or whatever. So it became something that was a real useful language to express what I feel so passionately about being able to go on performing myself. So I created a vehicle that I could ride in and enjoy. And that was a really important part of my performing I haven't completely answered your question, but I can.
No, but it's also, I mean, it's fascinating for me to sort of remember why I had the impetus for my PhD, which was focused on cross-generational dance and used crossover as very much a point of departure for that, because I got involved later on as a performer, and that phenomenon that you're talking about of people going, oh, I can see myself in this, and therefore feeling like they had permission to move and dance themselves, was the phenomenon that got my kind of research head kind of going, oh, this is a brilliant thing, and this is like a model that could be recreated, and we could get more people dancing. I mean, that was kind of part of the impetus for it. The reality is that actually a lot of it was also about your very specific culture that you had built up around Oxford Youth Dance, and how crossover connected to that, and the parents, like you said, and the wider family networks and friends, and actually recreating that model somewhere where that wasn't there yet. You know, it's 35 years of work, of practice in a place, isn't it? Yeah. And so I think that was one of the real kind of challenges and takeaways of my research project, was around that kind of more slow community building and growth that's necessary for a model like that. But I still think, like you say, there was something very powerful about that kind of visibility that it gave to dancers of different ages and working together, and there's certainly been projects that kind of are doing that now in more intentional ways, I think, but you were one of the first, I think. Not in Europe, but certainly in the UK. So yeah, where were we? I was talking about now and what you might be working on now. But yeah, having said that, I'm also tempted to go right back, because you just said something about, so that was the vehicle I created, if you like, for me to ride in, which made me think about bicycles. And then what made me think about cycles. And, you know, this wonderfully small world of sort of talking to Emmeline on the podcast a couple of months ago, and now you, and thinking about that time in the 60s when you were setting up again something quite radical and new in terms of a cooperative dance company that worked collectively. Am I right in thinking that that was Cycle's aim, as it were?
Well, we were definitely a cooperative, which was a new thing.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because, again, I'm referring to lockdown, which I hate referring to, but it was a brilliant gift that happened in lockdown. So a PhD student, Rachel Davis, who was doing research on Chisenhale and read a lot about cycles, because we were there, cycles at Chisenhale, and so mentioned there. And she came to us and said, I want to do an archive and an exhibition based on cycles. So it was like a wonderful gift. So core members of us, eight of us from all over the world and around, came together researching on Zoom, but then for real as well. And we put on in the Coventry Biennale last year, or in the lot 2 years ago, in Rugby, we had an exhibition that Rachel put up, and we did a performance that we created with Sally in America doing film for it, and the five of us
dancing,
and a musician. And we were, you know, there we were, just were we out of lockdown, just maybe it was just after Christmas, and had two audiences of 50 coming into the gallery, and people from past, present and future, our youth groups, our adult groups, my dugout group came and watched, and Judy Webb's ballet class came and were inspired by it, and dancers like Emlyn and not Emlyn didn't come, but Fergus and Jackie and Craig and lots of dancers came to see what we were up to. So we were really going back and forward. And what was fabulous for me was that I started reading some of the writing that was done, particularly by a young woman who did a thesis, her BA thesis on cycles. And so we had a really good little Bible of work that recorded all the things we couldn't remember very well. And I remember reading it and thinking, what I did with cycles, and I can tell you how it was formal, why it's formal if you have time, but what I did with cycles, what we did with cycles, but what I did is what I'm doing exactly, without sounding really boring, with dugout and with the children. And what it was, what we did then, all that long time ago in the 60s, We took dance that was so elitist and only could be afforded to be done by people who could pay for private dance classes, a certain sector of society then who could do that. And the form was only seen, you know, in ballet houses where only certain people could see it. And we wanted to take it onto the shop floor, into schools, you know, and that was just so brilliant because we made dance, this funny subject, dance. What is it if it's not ballet? We began to feed it in from our base in Leamington. But the brilliant thing was that I realised that my dugout, my adult community group, all these years ago, I haven't changed. That's exactly what I'm doing, what I did with the children. Without sounding utterly boring, I think it's my philosophy, is sound in my passion to make sure that as many people as possible get some dance in their lives. And that dance,
I mean, that
something...
doesn't sound boring to me. That sounds, that sounds like a kind of very clear value-driven dance practice, that, you know, there's a value at the heart of it, and then whatever you're doing is built around that. And that has great integrity. I don't think that's boring at all. So, but I suppose thinking about cycles, I said the 60s and it's the 70s, wasn't it? When probably, that's what I realised. Not that old. But could you, so maybe it'd be useful thinking, because some people might not know what cycles was, to just say what it was and how it kind of began.
So it was one of the, it was in the period where we began to have in each of the dance regions, the regional dance organisations and small dance companies began to be created by each of the regions. So they had their own companies. It still to a certain extent happens, but in a different kind of way and funded differently. And so I wanted, having been at the place and then have my first job at Scottish Theatre Ballet as a movable workshop director and teacher and performer. I just wanted to create something that was a vehicle I could ride. And so I decided I wanted to start my own dance company. And that way I would find something that I could ride with my dance and my beliefs and stuff then. So just to empower myself, I mean, I didn't really use that word then. And so I went to dancers who I'd been at the place with, and I got funding. And then for a year, we had this dance company that we called Cycles. I don't know, Ruth, how many, this is editing time. I don't know about revealing why it's called Cycles. So you probably...
No, that's fine. I was thinking more, was I think a lot of graduates will resonate with the thing of sort of going, well, I'm going to do my own thing and set my own thing up, rather than, you know, we call it a portfolio career now, where you do a bit of this and a bit of that. And it's kind of moving away from that thing of sort of auditioning and getting a contract for a company, which is rarer. And I feel like I want to be quite transparent with students about that, because that is more the world that you'll be kind of entering. But I suppose I was curious about your decision to run it as a cooperative, as being a very clear intention, and whether you have any memories of how that played out. Did it work?
Yeah, I think it's really good. It's interesting to talk about cooperatives, because actually most funding organisations and theatres didn't like a co-op. We were, who did they talk to? You know, they didn't have the top person. They didn't have the artistic director. And we were ahead of ourselves, if you like. And somebody actually took me aside and said, it'd be so much better if you were the director, then we'd have somebody to talk to. And I said, no, we're a co-op. And we all choreograph on each other. We all teach each other and we all perform. And then there was the feeling, I think there really was a patronizing feeling, that the standard wouldn't be as good. It wouldn't be as good if you had an artistic director, you'd have a vision. It would be one. It was based on all the other companies that people knew about. And we were really pushing it. And we had to really push and push to, sometimes we lost funding because of it, because they just wanted to have somebody. I remember when I was pregnant and I came out and did more administration, I remember having one person in the arts organized funding organization who was grateful, because she said, now you can direct it. And I didn't want to. I said, no, we're still working as a co-op. So it was a very different thing.
Interesting.
I'm glad we stuck to it, because out of it came a lot of individuals who had a lot to say and do, and also as dancers were empowered to know that they could say and do it. They weren't just tools for people to move around.
Yeah, and I feel like, as you said, like maybe slightly ahead of your time or something, in the sense
somebody said that to us, Ruth. They said, you're ahead of your time. And I wasn't sure whether that was a compliment or an insult at the time.
Well, possibly a kind of annoyed, well, you're just like, we're not there yet. Calm down. Don't stop.
But almost like you're inventing something that doesn't need to be invented. We always will need, the hierarchy was that we'll always need artistic director of a company.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you don't work through those periods of kind of discomfort of like, how do we actually change working practices? And I mean, we talk about that quite a lot in the different things that I'm involved in, of sort of how can we genuinely sort of flatten hierarchies? And it is really problematic. It's very challenging, and partly because of all the structures and things that are sort of set up.
And how we measure success. I mean, if success is about climbing a ladder, that at the top is the artistic director or the main choreographer, then if you're not doing that, I did a TED talk in a school a few years ago, and I decided to do something really based around that kind of hierarchy. And I took in, I thought people remember props more than they remember words in these kind of. So I took in a stepladder, a freestanding stepladder, and a plant, a tree in a pot, and I put it there as part of my talk. And during the first part of the talk, I climbed the ladder to the top, and I just said, this is how I thought my career, because these were to students, sick formers who were going off to do whatever in their careers. And I started going up the ladder, and I said, you know, this is what I was thinking when I was at studying, when I was at the place. And you have to climb a ladder. When you get to the top, you know what you're doing. And I got up there on the ladder and I said, you know what, it's really lonely up here. There's nowhere else to go. I can see you all, but I can't touch you. And actually, I feel quite dangerous because this ladder could fall and I've got nowhere else to go. So I came down and I went to the tree, the plant in the pot, the tree in the pot, and I touched it and went up the branches and my hands and stuff. And I said, this is rooted and it's got branches and it's got leaves and it's going to grow and change all the time. And this is my life. So I just said, this is my suggestion to you guys, is that you don't climb ladders, but you actually plant seeds. And then out of those seeds come all these branches that will blossom and create all kinds of new things, which of course for me symbolically became Oxford Youth Dance and everything after that. Because when people said to me, where do you get your dancers from? Well, I've planted all these seeds without knowing it. And I've got dancers of all ages that I can work with whenever I want to within my local scene and nationally too. But it's you're one of those seeds, Ruth.
Yeah, I know. Look at, hello, little seed over here, sprouted in all kinds of ways. Yeah, I think that's a lovely metaphor, and also sort of, you know, the bringing it into your, you were there performing for them as well, so that
I performed as well after as well,
so that also makes it very real, doesn't it? There's with my philosophy head on, I'm thinking about the there's these some philosophers, Deleuze and Guattari, who talk about the rhizome, which is essentially kind of networks of roots and branches. It's sort of talking about non-linear thinking and ideas and the way that things connect differently. And I think, you know, the way that you've built community and the way that that has spread and been allowed to kind of have these lovely connections and knock-on effects is part of a different way, like you say, of defining success and relating to your work, really. So in terms of these seeds that have been planted, I'm aware that we've zigzagged around. I'm still trying to pin you down to now. So like, where are you working on anything now? Like, what is your practice today around this time?
I'm only teaching on a regular basis, one group, the adult group.
Yeah.
So I stopped the children's work. I guest teach quite a lot, so I do other work as well. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm referring to lockdown. After lockdown, I made a film, two or three films, but it's this fire that I have this fire in me, that if it was out, I think I'd be dead. And I think that's why I talk about my dance will go on till my last blink. And I've been performing a lot, and far more than I ever thought I would do. And so I just literally, I think I said it to you in an email when we were communicating, I just performed in the International Women's Festival in Oxford in the town hall last week. And I've never done, we've had call out for that endlessly, but I've never done it before. And I just thought, I'd like to do this. And I have a piece of work with a fiddle player, Judith Henderson, who I work with, that we worked on after lockdown and performed in March 2022 in a theatre. And I just approached her and said, can we do this? And she was absolutely happy to do it. And we performed it. And performed it in a completely different setting, in a town hall, with loads of people with coffee and tea round tables, and a completely wild setting with only one other dance item. And I was really nervous, would it work? And actually, it worked better than just working. It took off in that I received comments that I will treasure. For example, there was a group of Ukrainian dancers who did a flash mob, which was beautiful. And we were sharing a dressing room, and there was a man with them, a youngish man, and he hugged me after it. And he was crying. And he just said, you reminded me of my wife who we used to dance. And this is editing time, I'm sure, but it was just like, it was so smashing to have somebody, total stranger, say this. And I also met two scientists who work in Oxford, but and they said to me after the performance, I loved what you did, and you're going to live a long time. And I looked at them and I said, well, I didn't say, well, I've already done that, but I thought, oh, and I said, where did you get this from? They said, how you were dancing and what you were doing. And it was just like, I was being really honest. I don't mess around with pretending anymore. I came out of a hole that was dark because lockdown took me there, and then gave myself permission to come out, but really honestly. And I still have a mentor, so I see my mentor once a term, which is Helen Poynier, whose work I'm influenced by hugely. And when I saw her last week and told her about this, I said, I was dancing in a way that I don't think I remember dancing. I can't do it. I thought I couldn't do it. And she said, it was your soul. And I think she's right. I think my soul was dancing. So it's like, oh, hey, well, I've got to kindle that. I can't let that go. Oh, so I'm just about to do another performance with a cellist for Bhutto Company I work with, for an event they've got in Oxford next week, a week in April. And again, it's going to be a dialogue this time between the cellist and myself. And we've been touring that on and off. We just haven't done it since lockdown. So again, I'm digging it out. And you could say, haven't you done enough? Why don't you just stop? It's because I'm still alive and I need to burn and I need to share. And it keeps my soul and body alive.
Beautiful. Yeah. I mean, you keep apologizing for bringing up lockdown, but I think lockdown has shaped us in so many different ways, personally and artistically, that whole experience, and has been one that has connected us in new ways, and also, you know, led to soul searching indeed, you know, for us in different ways because of the lack of connection. So I think it's a really seismic kind of shift, and it's really fine to kind of, there's like a before and after, isn't there, in a way, and like you say it's a catalyst for certain things, and also a way to really, I mean, this podcast started in lockdown, and it was a way for me to stay connected to the practice that I loved and to the kinds of conversations that I need to also keep me alive. And it's sort of how we discuss and share about this practice that I'm so invested in. So, and then I kept thinking I won't do another episode, and then I meet more wonderful people and think, oh, but I haven't spoken to them about this. So it keeps going. But I think, I suppose I just, it's a really beautiful note in a way to end on what you said about keeping your soul alive and dancing. And I think the scientists sort of saying to you, you're going to live a long life though as well. It's sort of interesting, this thing as you age and kind of how people might respond to you differently because of that, I guess. And I think, you know, there's an element to that comment that might be taken a little bit sort of patronizing almost. I don't know, but it sounds like you didn't take it like that.
No, it wasn't.
I'm sort of wary of that thing of talking to an older practitioner, I guess, and also in the conversation with Emmeline, obviously she's coming back to performance, and it's really so inspiring, basically. And even saying that, I'm like, I don't want to put you in a different category that's like, oh, you're such an inspiration. But there is something that's very heartening about being a woman in my 40s, talking to a woman in her 70s, who's still finding layers and layers of what their practice means to them and stuff. So I'm super grateful that you are out there in the world doing this stuff. And I think the other thing, the danger is to get into kind of reminiscence and what's gone before and sort of like we were saying, this chronology, when actually it's like, oh, you're still making work and practicing now. And that's really exciting. So I suppose my final question is about dance futures, so looking ahead, and I guess how that is for you at this point in your life to look ahead, and how much do you do that, particularly obviously in relation to your practice, but also whether there's anything that you are really, I think you've probably articulated it already, but really hoping for or wanting in a dance future more generally. That was a very long-winded way of getting to that question. So do let me know if you need me to repeat anything.
Well, I think I can answer it. But you may, again, you'll be editing constantly. There's something else I wanted to say that seems to be rising, which seems really important to anyone who's going to be thinking of dancing in their life, whether as a dancer, a student, a professional, that... it's just coming up. I think things come up as you get older and you hold on to them. Yeah. So without naming names, when I did my first job in Scotland with Scottish Theatre Ballet, I had a boss who, when I left, was cross that I was leaving, because I think I could have stayed on, but I didn't. I wanted to move on with my partner. And he said to me, you've got to accept your limitations. And I remember it so clearly, and I don't remember verbatim a lot of things. And I actually know, I mean, if I were to meet him again, I would actually really want him to hear this, that I've been celebrating my limitations all my life. If I'd accepted my limitations, I would have stopped and become a gardener or whatever it was that I might have become. By accepting my limitations and celebrating them, I've actually been able to do all the things. Why did I start cycles? Because I wanted to find a vehicle that my form, my movement came from. I wasn't going to just go, okay, I'm not going to do this thing that I love. And that stayed right the way through. And so it's relevant, obviously, to me now as an older dancer. I'm stiffer, bigger. But the limitations are, to accept limitations is narrowing one's life. And it's like that corridor or the stepladder. To actually celebrate them is about planting those seeds and seeing what happens, and the endless dancers who I now meet who are dancing because of what they got from the seeds that they grew from. So I think that is that. And then the other thing, there are a number of obviously people once inspired by, and I just made sure that I had this here to accurately quote it, because of all the people, you know, Martha Graham with her, taught by so many people at the place, and so angstful. And there's two things, and you can look at it yourself, but I love this one, which is that she says, great dancers are not great because of their technique. They're great because of their passion. And I think I'm lucky. You can't, when I used to teach students at university, I say, I've got something that you can't buy, you can't teach, you've got to find it in yourself. And when I said passion, it was often like a laugh, because what did that mean? But I think if we have passion, it's like a lifeblood. It is my soul. It is what people saw in me performing. So I think that is the main quote. There's another one, but it's longer.
And so, yeah, that will carry you forwards as well, as anything. And I think, yeah, what you're saying about accepting your limitations or celebrating them, I think some people might use the language of accepting your limitations as a way to also say what you're saying, which is that if you kind of embrace them as a way to find what you actually need and to create what you need in your life, rather than it being about limitations as a full stop, then that is actually an amazing resource. And I think it shows real kind of resilience and sort of creativity as well, isn't it? It's how the creative spirit, if you like, kind of works, is to it's like the way water will find a way through, won't it?
Exactly.
I'm thinking about the
exactly.
leak in my roof. I'm like, oh God, you know, and you can kind of block it up, block the dam, but it will find a way through.
Exactly, exactly. That's a nice metaphor. Yeah, I love it.
I think that's a really beautiful thing to end on as we find our way forwards. And thank you for a very inspiring conversation, Cecilia. And I look forward to more of those over tea very soon. I'm just going to hit record.
Recording in progress.
Luca, you're not in your cupboard though.
No, I know. Sorry. Well, I'm on holiday, so I can't really complain.
Continuity's sake, you're in your apartment.
Yeah, there might be some background noise from the nature outside and, you know.
Oh, it looks really nice and sunny and just, yay. So I was thinking about how this interview with Cecilia, and as I said to her, I think at the beginning, there's something for me that's quite poignant about this, like, teacher, mentor, student kind of relationship and how that shifts over time. And obviously also looking at you, who is my student, and then like talking with Kira and Boone and kind of I learned from you in these different ways, as well as you having learned from me and etc. And so speaking to Cecilia felt kind of poignant because she was a massive part of why I even felt kind of empowered to carve a career for myself in dance that wasn't the traditional route. And having spoken to very recent graduates, you know, in the previous month's episode, you know, it felt like this kind of, just amazing perspective, I guess, that I have of being in between those places and looking ahead and looking back. And it was quite a reflective moment for me. So I have a lot of personal connection to Cecilia, but I wondered what it was like for you listening to the interview as somebody without that, I guess, and from a different place. Yeah,
I mean, just listening to the conversation that you had, it was so evident that Cecilia just has this absolute wealth of knowledge and experience from all of the things she's participated in and led, even if she wasn't in that kind of like directorial role as you were discussing in the cooperatives. But maybe all of the seeds that she's planted, and it was really, really clear that she just had this whole bank of interesting things to share. And
the seeds, like you say, that was a metaphor that she really liked to use, and she likes to work with images and metaphors a lot. And I think that thing of planting the seeds, and maybe there's something about when you're older, that there is a sense of being able to look at how those seeds have evolved in a very like real sense as well. Like these young children that you taught are now like out in the world making stuff happen. And that's pretty, that's pretty amazing.
And I was so, I was writing notes as I was listening, thinking about what I was going to say in our conversation now. And it was this amazing moment of, realization of the conversation, talking about planting these seeds and mentoring people and passing on knowledge and experiences. Because I was listening to the conversation, I was thinking, oh yeah, and this idea of not having hierarchy and sharing ideas and being in a cooperative, it's like that Rhizome article I read, and then you brought it up in the conversation. I was like, oh my God, I'm exactly the student of Ruth, because that was an article that you shared with us when I was at uni.
Yes.
I was like, I'm full circle that like we're, that lineage of knowledge is kind of, even though we don't want to be talking about linearness, but you know.
Yeah, I think, and that's really beautiful. And it's something that I've always really appreciated about you, Luca, is the way that you can, I can't remember what you sent me the other day. Oh yeah, you sent Edward Said Orientalism. But yeah, we would just the way that theory can like permeate into your everyday life a little bit more than some. I think sometimes it's much more compartmentalized. And for me, it's always been something that's fed into how I live as well, and therefore make connections with others, etc. And so, yeah, I love that you had that same thought as me. And of course, it's one of those moments where I'm like, oh, I must go back and actually remind myself what the hell Deleuze and Guattari did say, because I was there. So I'm there kind of going, making this like really, you know, shorthand reference, this incredibly complex idea. But what I was also going to say about that is I also think it's really important that we use theory like that, and we allow ourselves to make mistakes with it, and kind of, because we're actually like making it real and we're living it, we're like really trying to go, oh well, how does this apply to my life, rather than like just exactly what it says in the book or whatever. So yeah, I'm really pleased that you made that connection as well.
Yeah, I felt like I gave myself a
little pat.
Like, well done, me.
Yeah, good. Well, I'm not there to give them to you. Yeah, and I thought it was really interesting what she said about what the cooperative that you've mentioned a couple of times there, and the thing of like maybe almost being a bit ahead of her time in that way, and that people were kind of not ready for it. Whereas I feel like now maybe there is more of that energy, at least in kind of up and coming ways of being and working. I don't know if that resonates for you.
Yeah, and I think particularly dancers of my generation really recognizing those systems of power and wanting to challenge the idea that the director or the choreographer gets all the credit for the work. And actually, as we know from the way dance often works in the studio, that the dancers come up with at least 50% of what gets put on stage, you know. The way that most choreographic tasks work rely on the people who will end up performing it on stage to generate new ideas. And I think once we recognize that choreographers and directors, and this isn't a kind of them and us conversation, it's most of us will fluctuate between being choreographer, performer, director throughout our portfolio careers, as you said. But once we recognize that the people with the leading titles in a piece of, in a process, have less kind of absolute power in the way that, that's recognized, I think the better, the sooner that happens.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's been the Name That Dancer campaign with One Dance UK. I think that might have been in like around 2012 or something. And so I feel like there's been these surges of recognition of this. But it's also a bit like, yeah, it's something that's still quite hard to kind of unhook from, because it exists as a sort of idea. So it's like these ideological things, right, that like we have to actively challenge them, otherwise we can just fall back into them. And I think the notion of kind of actually setting up companies as cooperatives, or really looking at your working practices, like your actual mechanisms for how you're operating. I feel like I see that, maybe I said this in the interview, but I feel like I see that, I've seen that in friends that work in the kind of more progressive end of tech, that these tech companies really trying to work with kind of open source technologies and in like cooperative ethical working structures that I've always been kind of like, oh, what's that? And like, how can we learn from that more in the art kind of scene in general? And I'm definitely not alone in that. There's all kinds of people that have been working really radically and to create those things. But yeah, it was nice to hear Cecilia talking like that, because I guess that's like also before I knew her, right, in the 60s and 70s, when she was you know, again reacting kind of against certain things which she spoke about, and so therefore you're kind of looking to create these alternatives. And then when I met her, and how our paths intersect, was very much in this kind of teaching and facilitation, and Oxford Youth Dance as this kind of real sense of extended family and community, the like of which I just haven't really experienced in any other setting. It's quite something.
It's kind of a double-edged sword of the dance industry, if we want to use that word industry, working so hard to get recognized by as a sort of valid and worthy community in a wider sense, that the downside to all of that work that's gone into getting that recognition has been that we've kind of had to mold and mirror the kind of capitalist systems of other industries around us. You know, who's in charge? The problem of funding, and always, do we make work to get paid? Do we make work to make money? And that should, it never was and never should be the root of wanting to do dance. I never went and studied dance to make money.
Like, which is a relief, isn't it? Because you would be now going like, what the actual hell? Flaw in the plan. Yeah, absolutely. There are other kinds of drive, different value systems at play. And I think we've spoken about this before a lot, which is the, you know, there's the flip side of that again of, you know, that doesn't mean let's exploit people because they love what they do and therefore they'll do it for the love, right? Like, no, pay us for our time, but also we recognize that we're kind of entering a different kind of economy of value with what we do and how we share that with others, etc. And that can be a really precious, precious thing. I guess I was thinking about it also in relation to, if anyone can be a dancer, what does that make what does that make you who's trained in dance? Do you see what I mean?
A dancer? I'm joking.
Love it. That's hilarious. Because I also, he's joking, everybody, but also he is really good.
I don't take myself that seriously. I need everyone to know.
Exactly. I think there is something around, valuing though also that training, and that if you are someone who loves to dance, hopefully, you know, there's something in you that also will love and celebrate other people dancing for different reasons and on. But, you know, someone might watch you and get real pleasure from seeing someone who has been professionally trained. So I feel like there's still something to recognize in that, in the value, in the time and effort that you've put in to do that training, I guess.
Yeah. And I think more and more, especially when I'm in spaces which have relation to dance, but I'm not necessarily the focus, you know, like I'm not in a performative space as a solo dancer or with a company. So an example of this, there was a music event last summer outside a live band playing, and people were kind of like bopping around and like having a little dance. And I think whether or not it was the beer that I had drunk that made a difference, but you know, I was dancing too. And then afterwards, this guy came up to me. He also works at the school that I work at, and he works in the tech department. And he just said, thank you so much. You've like your energy and your just that carefree attitude. He said, I felt that I was able to dance because you were dancing.
That's so nice, yeah.
And it was lovely. And I think examples of that, you realize that when you have these skills and this, I think a dance training can teach you to be less self-conscious about expressing things through physical movement, that you're really a facilitator wherever you go. And I really like that word, that you can facilitate other people's joy through moving.
That's lovely, Luca. It's a really nice observation. And again, I think, Cecilia is very much a facilitator. So that, like you say, that word and that role. I really recognize that as well. But I feel like, again, sometimes I'm like, am I taking up too much space? Or kind of making people feel less confident because I'm there letting rip on the dance floor.
It's a really fine balance, right?
Also sometimes if I'm not in the mood, as in like I'm finding a bit hard to get going, I will watch other people dance and just really tune into their love of the music or whatever it is and just be like, yes. And that, and again, some of that is perhaps through the training I've had to really empathize and connect kinesthetically with other bodies, which means that it can give me something in a way. But I also wonder, I think maybe that is accessible to more people, just through the, you know, the atmosphere in the scene or whatever, the dance floor. And this is so perfect because I do really want to do a geek out this month, right? And I'm doing it on this book, which I'm going to hold up for you, which is called Dance Your Way Home, A Journey Through the Dance Floor by Emma Warren. Okay. And so I'm going to talk about that in the geek out. But the introduction says, if you dance, you're a dancer. This is where we begin. So, and she's really sort of clear about why she's defining herself as a dancer, as someone who's danced a lot in clubs. And I have an interesting relationship with this book as a dance academic as well. So I'm going to do a geek out. I'm going to talk a bit about that. And I think it will really bring into play. So that example that you've just given is perfect. It's like a real perfect meeting point with some of the things that she talks about. So thank you, as always, for your insight and your experience and sharing that with us. And actually, I feel really happy that you're not in the cupboard.
Yeah, I'm free.
Free.
I want to pick up on the conversation you had about the issue of gender in dance.
Yes, I remembered that. Yeah,
it was such a big part of the conversation.
Yeah, and
it's obviously something that I currently and always have been interested in relation to dance. And I think the easiest way for me to, I wrote it down, so maybe I read this out. Boys only ever have to step on stage to be rewarded. After the school shows I was part of, the feedback was always, it's great to see so many boys dancing. But there were lots of girls dancing too, and much better than us, but it was expected of them. And for us boys, all we had to do was show willing. And I think that's tragic within the dance sector, that boys are often spoon-fed and mentored opportunities, because I know I was. But from a wider, broader societal perspective, what careers male-identifying people can go on to do, it should be encouraged that young men and boys can nurture creativity, compassion, and self-expression. But sadly, somewhere along the way, this has happened at the expense of anyone that society doesn't see as male presenting by way of being worthy. And so we have this paradox in society, whether that's local, national, or global, that it's imperative that we have boys entering those creative fields. But once they're in it, it can and does become detrimental to women and non-male identifying people. And it's really difficult to talk about this paradox without being binary in our view of gender. And then I think I was like, so how do we challenge that? And to me, the obvious answer is just to queer everything.
Yeah,
so,
totally, always. It's the answer for everything.
Very simply, very simply. And I think when we queer dance, when we queer anything, we obviously blur those lines and we celebrate and champion all types of people. And we give anyone who wants and works. And I think that's really important, because it's not just about, oh, I want to be a dancer. Okay, well, you have to work for that, right? When we're talking about really having a career in it. And I think anyone who wants it and works for that, there should be the opportunities for them to do that. And I was writing that and I was like, oh, maybe that just sounds so wishy-washy and kind of naive and silly, but isn't this the point of our podcast, that we are talking about dance futures, and that's the way that we hope to see the dance world moving? So I think
I think it's not wishy-washy, it's kind of going, there are some very practical things that need to be put in place to enable that sense of equality of opportunity, right? And that's, you know, across the board in so many situations. And I think you're right, the queering kind of project, as it were, of kind of how this fluidity that actually, like you say, is also not boxing men and male identified people into certain ways of moving and being in the world is a huge part of how we stop that sense of kind of rarefied, oh, look at him, he's doing the thing that we're not expecting of him, and that then is also detrimental to women and female identifying people. So yeah, it's, and like you say, it is a tricky paradox that becomes very binary when we speak about it. I think it's maybe useful to notice that Cecilia's very much talking about her lived experience of working with Oxford Youth Dance. And I was like, gosh, yeah, like when I think about it, actually, because I know some of those boys that she's talking about, and they are dancing with Hofesh Sektor, with Rombert, with Punch Drunk, you know, and that's what we're seeing of coming through Oxford Youth Dance. But and I don't know about other examples. So that's a very small, you know, it's a small little window.
It's anecdotal, not
it's
not
anecdotal. Big. Thank you. Thank you. That's the word I'm looking for. Oh yeah, so thank you for reminding me of that, because I did think that as well. I thought, oh, here it comes again, you know, like gender just has come up in so many of our conversations, hasn't it? And I'm sure it will continue to, which is no bad thing.
Not at all.
All right, Luca. What's next for you? Where are you headed next?
School starts officially again next week. So
okay.
Oh, but I'm going to Madrid. I forgot that. It's an easy life.
Yes. I love that for you. Yeah. So right. Well, good luck with that and back to school. And see you next time.
Bye.
Hi. Welcome to the Geek Out. So I just wanted to do a little kind of addition to the bit of theory trashing, as I'm going to call it, that Luca and I did in relation to rhizomic thinking earlier. I really believe in what I said to Luca about how I think it's really important and great and useful that we work with theory as it arises in our minds in the everyday, and this kind of cut and paste it and use it how we want. I think Jonathan Culler, who wrote one of the very short introduction series, this one to literary theory, who said that theory is defined by its practical effects. And I love that. It should kind of change the way we think. So I love that. So I think, yeah, like really bringing theory to bear on everyday life and practical experiences is how I want to roll with it. However, sometimes means when I'm pulling something out from the dregs of my brain that I don't get it entirely accurate, and maybe a theoretical perspective loses some of the subtleties or nuance. I just wanted to clarify something, which is this thing about because Cecilia uses the tree as a metaphor, right, and these seeds and growth, it's kind of an archetypal metaphor. Excuse my computer. An archetypal metaphor for growth and the bearing of fruit. But Deleuze and Guattari, the philosophers responsible for this idea of rhizomic thinking and knowledge, make a distinction between that and arborescent thinking, tree-like thinking. I have to say that that word, arborescent, is just giving me joy right now. So they make a distinction between arborescent thinking, which suggests this linearity and this kind of hierarchical growth mindset that leads up towards the bearing of fruits, as I said, that, and a rhizome, by contrast, is where any point can be connected to any other point. And that's quite radically different. It creates a network. It creates a degree of chaos. It creates loads of divergent ways that anything can evolve. And I guess that's one of the exciting things about it, all these multiple entry points. And I think it's why it's a popular theory, often with creative thinkers and practitioners, because they find resonance with that idea. So now I've got that off my chest, I can get back to talking about dancing. So I mentioned in my chat with Luca about this great new book that I heard about on another podcast by Emma Warren. It's called Dance Your Way Home, A Journey Through the Dance Floor. And I just want to read out the quote in the opening of the book, which is from Theo Parrish, who is an American house DJ and producer. He said, "Escapism has always been an adjective used to describe the dance that's an outsider's view. Solidarity is what it really offers. Now, that quote just says such a lot about the motivation that so many people feel to get together and dance. And Emma Warren's book, it's one of those ones where I heard about it and I immediately had to get it and had that kind of pang when you kind of feel like, I wish I'd written this book. She goes into her own kind of Irish background and lived experience, and so obviously it's very particular to her. Can you hear it? Look, it's a real life book. That's its pages turning. But it is a wonderful kind of centering of dance in these experiences of club culture and rave and reggae sound system culture, all things that have also been really important to me in terms of a kind of my personal and professional life, and the way that those two things have been able to meet has been amazing as I've kind of dipped into the wealth of research on social dance practices or cultural studies that really has understood these as phenomenons that arise because of particular kind of social conditions or as responses to forms of oppression. And so I love this book. I love the opening title, the opening steps, as she calls it, that I read to Luca. If you dance, you're a dancer. This is where we begin. What a great premise, and so in tune with what Cecilia has been promoting through her community dance practice over the years. And I think usually in this section, I find something kind of fairly obscure bit of dance scholarship and try and make that a bit more kind of accessible. And I guess one of the reasons I do that is because, as I've said before, it's a niche, this world that I have the privilege to exist in and to dialogue in, I guess, with other colleagues in this area. And but I feel like it has so much to offer people outside of the field, and to kind of really share that, because we all live in our bodies, right? So it's not to universalize experience, because there are so many different forms of lived experience, and that's really key. And I think Luca and I were talking about how Cecilia's observations are anecdotal, and Emma Warren goes out of her way too to really make that clear that she's writing from her own specific perspective. And I think I have a slightly complex relationship to the book, because there is a whole field of dance research that kind of hasn't been mentioned. And this is obviously a conscious decision, and there are individuals who are mentioned in there. So Teresa Buckland, a dance anthropologist, Judith Lynn Hanna, who wrote the book To Dance is Human, more contemporary scholar Simon Ellis is mentioned. There are people dotted through the book that are very much embedded in the dance kind of scholarship and research field, and this is not trying to be an academic book. And so I think I have some envy around how, if you're not trying to write an academic book, you can just write. And academia sometimes prevents that, because there are so many, it feels like hoops to jump through. But part of that is also about kind of standing on the shoulders of standing on the shoulders of. And I'm trying to feminize that, because so many dance researchers are women. Not all. But I think, so there's a sadness there also with this book that I feel it hasn't done that. It hasn't kind of situated itself in relation to some amazing work on social dance and participating in dance and what it means for us. And one of my favourites is Helen Thomas's book Dance in the City, which has a series of chapters, one of which is called The Beat Goes On, Trance, Dance and Tribalism in Rave Culture. And this book really situated dance in urban contexts, and I guess again was like bringing dance into the conversation where before it usually often focused on the music. Lots of studies of kind of club culture have focused on the music and the kind of analysis of what the actual bodies are doing, the importance of the bodies moving in space gets lost. So that's one of the things that I love about the book, right, is the fact that it really does do that. It centers the dancing, and for anybody who has wondered why they might be so driven to seek out these spaces, this book is so worth a read, and it is affirming and joyful and gives a brilliant sense of sort of purpose and context to this whole aspect of culture that is quite often denigrated or seen as something that is, as the opening quote says, just an escape or hedonistic or entertainment. Again, something that many of the dance scholars that I refer to have fought against, that conception of dance as something that's just a sort of distraction almost. So I'm just going to finish with a little quote from the book. So this is the author, Emma Warren, talking about visiting a friend of hers and kind of reminiscing about when they used to go out dancing. And I think this is something that I encounter a lot when I talk about what I do. There are so many stories and so many joyful memories that revolve around these kinds of situations. But I love the way that this is so specifically kind of thinking about what the body did. So her friend Dawn says, "Hold on, how did we dance?" She stops, remembering it, not just in her mind's eye, but in her body. She reorganizes her frame to try to find the right starting point, then clenches her fists, moving her hands down staccato. Her body is remembering for her. She moves, and for a split second she's 14 again, and she's on the spot, dancing in a tight square of her own kitchen-turned dance floor, balls of the feet connecting so that her heels can move side to side like windscreen wipers in opposition to each other, fists punching down across the body on one side and then the other. Her hair is extending the shape she's making in a kind of counterpoint, an upside-down metronome, rocking out to the reimagined sounds of air sirens and sampled drum breaks. Dancing relates to release and repair, to controlling your movements and to being controlled. Here in Dawn's kitchen, it's also time travel. So while we are all about traveling to our shared dance futures, maybe also, listeners, this is an invitation to travel to your dances past and reinvent them in your body in the here and now.